programs at the Foundation, and we're here today partly timed around a new PBS film, which I think you know will be airing as from tomorrow evening on PBS stations nationwide. And that's the spur for this important event. I think any of you who are familiar at all with filmmaking would know that documentary filmmaking is not for the faint-hearted, and certainly not if the focus is on health policy issues, which may explain why there are rather few documentary films about health policy issues. And for that, I just do want to commend Lisa Hartman for her grit and tenacity in getting this off the ground as the producer of the film, and Tom Reed, who we'll be hearing from shortly, who, of course, uses his typical spellbinding storytelling to bring to light some of the more complex and possibly arcane issues which many of you in Washington, of course, grapple with. As you know, this film looks at some of the regional success stories or perceived success stories in providing affordable care, and that's what we're really looking at today. And then we will be turning over. My colleague Jackie Judd will then moderate the panel, which will discuss in more detail the challenges in actually making some of these policies play out in the field. So without any more to do, I'm just going to turn over to Tom Reed and ask him to introduce the film. We'll then watch a short clip, and then Jackie will moderate the panel. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for coming. I need to say, just as an American, I need to say thank you to the Kaiser Family Foundation. This outfit has done fabulous work in teaching Americans about health care, health policy, about the problems with our rotten health system and some of the ways to fix it. Among the people that Kaiser has taught is me. I was just an ink-stained political reporter who got interested in health policy, and Penny and Kaiser took me under their wing and taught me health policy. It's been fabulous. I think some of us may have met here 2 or 3 years ago in this very room when we were showing the first showing of a film where we went around the world and looked at health care in other rich democracies. And what we were trying to show in that film, what that film showed, is that all the other countries like us, I mean by that advanced, high-tech, free market, wealthy democracies, all of them provide health care for everybody. On an average, they spend about half as much as we do in the process. And we made a movie about how these other countries managed to do it. Came home, the movie, you know, once you make a movie for PBS, they show it over and over. People see it at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, and in the grocery store, these insomniacs come up to me and say, weren't you in Germany seeing a doctor like that? And people started saying to me, you know, you didn't have to go around the world. You could have found really good, high-quality health care at reasonable cost right here in the United States. And I said, no, that's completely wrong. I wrote a whole book saying that's wrong, so that couldn't be right. And then we came upon the work of Dr. Jack Wenberg and Dr. Elliot Fisher at Dartmouth, who have proven this. And they, of course, wrote the Dartmouth Atlas of Healthcare. And on this atlas, Elliot Fisher pointed out to us communities where we could find really high-quality health care way below average costs. And we went around the country in this film to figure out how people do that. Is it true? And how do you do it? The most striking thing, we're only going to show a short part of the film here, but the most striking thing was in all sorts of different models, we found doctors and hospitals who found a way to get cost-controlled. Group Health in Seattle, it's 900 doctors, 25 clinics, and the insurance company all under one roof. Well, they made it work. Grand Junction, Colorado is more like a typical American town, 88 independent medical practices, fee-for-service medicine, 2 competing hospitals, and yet in that model they made it work, and we saw this in other models too. So that was, it was pretty striking. We showed this movie recently to somebody, and a fellow came up to me and said, I know the lesson of your movie. Maybe you don't want to hear this inside the Beltway, but the lesson is We don't have to wait for Washington to get control over costs in the United States because doctors and hospitals all over the country are doing it already. So today we're just going to show you a few minutes of this movie and then have a discussion about it. And I just want to point out kind of the unsung hero of making a movie is the producer. The producer has to do all the stuff. I'm the guy who gets to be on screen, but my job is really pretty easy. Our producer, Lisa Hartman, did a fabulous job. And one of the great things she did is she hired this sheer perfectionist, Rich Lerner, to be the cinematographer, the cameraman. And Rich is like, here's what happens. You go someplace to film something like the Baker Library in Dartmouth, and Rich says to me, he says, Tom, get out of here and come back in 2 hours. And then he completely transforms the place with lights and cables and microphones. And after 2 hours of this, finally I'm allowed to come in and sit down and ask a question. And I asked the first question, and this always happened. Rich said, oh, I'm sorry, Tom, it's not right. And he goes and he moves something about 2 centimeters. And this is okay, this is going to be okay. And I just mentioned this because we're just going to go quickly through this film, but I think what you'll see, if you notice, every time we interview somebody, the background is beautiful. No, I'm serious. Take a look. And maybe nobody would notice this. But this Rich Lerner did that. He shot a beautiful film. So take a look. Thank you.
On a lovely New England autumn day like this, economists here at Dartmouth College began studying Medicare billing records, millions of them. Sounds pretty boring, right? But in fact, they found something amazing, and they published their results in an influential study.
It's called the Dartmouth Atlas of Healthcare, and it's the definitive text on the subject of variation in American medicine.
We've known for 20 years that if you have twice as many cardiologists per capita in your community, you're going to have twice as many visits to cardiologists per capita. If you have twice as many scanners in your community, patients in those communities are going to get twice as many imaging services. There are some communities where the physicians and the hospital leaders are really starting to ask the question, how can we be responsible for the health of our community, not only in terms of their clinical health, but their fiscal health?
It's happening now?
It's happening all over the country. One of the first places I'd think of looking would be Grand Junction, Colorado.
This lively county seat on the western edge of Colorado has become a model for healthcare delivery because the doctors here did something amazing. It's a community that's just about average in family income and in the number of people without health insurance, but the doctors here decided to take care of everybody in town and to get paid the same fee for the same treatment, whether the patient is rich or poor.
The Medicaid patient in this community can not only see a doctor, the Medicaid patient can see any doctor that I could see as the head of the health plan. A requirement of being a physician in our network is that you agree to see all of our members.
So we built a system around a withhold from the physician's payments. So if a doc's supposed to be paid $100 for something, we would typically give him 80.
And then at the end of the year, based upon how well we did in terms of cost and quality measures, the physicians will get either all of that withhold back or a portion of it or none of it if we didn't hit our targets.
In a neighborhood called Factoria, Group Health has been pioneering a hot new idea in healthcare that's popping up in cities around the country. It's called the patient-centered medical home. Basically, it's a new way to manage the traditional doctor's office.
Dr. Polinati's office, Kathy speaking. Go ahead.
The docs are supposed to organize their day around the patient's schedule, and the whole medical team is responsible for every patient. That's why they get together every morning in this huddle to plan for the cases they'll see that day. It's supposed to make life better for the patients. But Dr. Harry Shriver, who runs the place, says the medical home idea is better for the doctors, too.
The other thing is we increased our time with patients to up to 30 minutes with a patient face-to-face. That was achieved by increasing something I never thought I'd do, was virtual medicine.
What does it mean?
That means we use the internet and a telephone to communicate with patients.
We know that for every dollar we spent to create the medical home, we saved $1.50. It wasn't just that we cut anything, cut jobs, cut services, rationed. It wasn't any of that. We saved money by the system acting like a system and having more appropriate utilization the way patients would want it.
Here in Everett, the structure is completely different. 300 docs in one big practice, but this place too is famous for controlling the costs of health care.
We have a goal to lower the cost of care to our patients by 25% in the next 5 years. We're hopefully going to accomplish that by mainly reducing institutional care, hospitalizations, emergency room visits. That will give health plans, hopefully, an opportunity to lower premiums.
This is kind of a comprehensive preventive care, and it saves money for everybody.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
I'm no longer in the complex care patient program.
And at the end of the project, Boeing actually saved 20% in costs. This was not bending the cost curve. This was saving money.
Can other communities do what's happened in Everett and Seattle?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Other communities can do it. It's a question of, and some are to varying extents, but it's a question of focus. It's a question of do you approach healthcare as something that you are doing for your community, or is it only a business?
The consensus is we would save hundreds of billions if every town in America could be as efficient as the places we've seen in this program.
It's doable. It's, you know, we've proved it. It's not that complicated.
It's doable all over the country if doctors, hospitals, and insurance plans will work together to keep track of costs and hold them down. It's doable if medical practices are willing to use new technology and new delivery models to give them more time with patients. It's doable if doctors are willing to give their patients a real voice in making treatment decisions.
How here, will this make it better or worse?
And it's doable if all of us insist that our local hospitals and local doctors perform as well as the places we've seen in this program. If every community would take those steps, we could finally achieve the goal of high-quality health care at reasonable cost for every American.
I'd like to add my welcome and invite the panelists to come up. And while they're getting settled, for the next hour or so, we're going to be talking about some of the issues that Tom teed up in his documentary. What is, for example, an accountable care organization? What are the chances and challenges of replicating these kinds of plans across the country? And what are some of the early lessons about what may have worked and what may not be working? And so with that, everyone's mics are on, I can hear?
Okay. At least we're making lots of noise.
I'll make some quick introductions. Much longer bios of each of our speakers is in the packet you received. Elliot Fisher, who you will recognize from the documentary, Dr. Elliot Fisher, is the director of the Dartmouth Atlas of Healthcare. Carol Beasley is the director of strategic projects at the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. Mark McClellan, welcome Mark, is the director of the Engelberg Center for Healthcare Reform at Brookings and, of course, a former CMS administrator. And Sean Cavanaugh is the acting deputy director of programs and policy at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation at CMS. Welcome to you all. Each of our guests will make some brief opening comments, and then we're going to open it up for questions from you and from me. Elliot?
Great. Thank you very much. What fun to be here. And Tom, what fun. I'm a little nervous about the role, but anyway. there is an emerging consensus about the problems facing the U.S. healthcare system: unaffordable costs, remarkably uneven quality. But I think the sense of crisis that we're feeling is in part because of what we saw in Tom's film. That is, we recognize that there's a tremendous inefficiency in the U.S. healthcare and that we're spending a lot of money on things that don't provide particular benefits to patients. And there's some issues around prices as well, as to whether those are reasonable everywhere. about, you know, our research over the last 20 years, and we've handed some of it out, suggests that a lot of the waste, as was pointed out in this film, is in unnecessary hospital stays, unnecessary visits, things that are, you know, that can be fixed, that can be improved through the science of improvement that's rapidly evolving. When, you know, Dr. McClellan left Medicare about, I can't remember how many years ago, a few years ago, we decided to try to work together to think about how could we take some of the principles that he had already applied in the physician group practice demonstration to get some more generalizable approaches to healthcare reform. And there were four principles that we came up with that are we've listed in some of our articles, but they're really interesting in the context of looking at these four healthcare systems. The first is, you know, one problem we face is that we're uncertain about what we're trying to achieve. Is it about the business of medicine, or is it about trying to improve the health of our populations? So clarity of aim becomes critically important, and it's now national, it's federal policy under the Secretary's quality, the quality framework for the United States, that the aims are better health, better care, and lower costs, all three, for patients and for communities. And that's, it's clear as you watch what those places are doing, that they're trying to do that. The second problem facing you with healthcare is that we're flying blind almost everywhere. You know, we've done a little bit of comparison with the Dartmouth Atlas, but there's completely inadequate information to help patients understand their choices, to help providers understand what they're doing in their practices so they can improve their practices, or to help consumers make wise choices among hospitals, among health plans, and among other providers. So the second principle that we agreed was critically important was we need much better information that engages consumers, engages patients, help them make wise choices, and lets them compare providers. The probably the most challenging problem facing American healthcare is the flawed conceptual model under which most physicians are currently trained. We think that the way you produce health in American medicine is by face-to-face visits with doctors. And the more face-to-face visits, the better off you are, especially if they're with specialists. If we look outside healthcare, what you see in industry is systems that are capable of improving and managing processes to make sure they're doing reliably what needs to be done. And so the third principle that we both agreed upon when we started working together on the accountable care organization notion was we need organizations that will be accountable for those aims, striving toward those aims, and then rewarded in ways that allow them to redesign practice, to improve care, to manage capacity, because we have a lot of unnecessary capacity in this system, and eliminate waste. Redesign care, eliminate waste, manage capacity through some kind of organizational structure that's capable of doing it. And the fourth principle that we saw as critically important was the financial incentives. We have financial incentives that reward that fragmentation. So we need to move toward incentives that start to think about how we're going to encourage docs to work together to coordinate care, to provide better care at lower cost and be rewarded for doing so. It is really telling, looking at the four examples. Dartmouth-Hitchcock was the one that was not named in the little clip where you saw Jim Weinstein do an orthopedic surgeon examining a patient. But all four of those systems are either already operating under payment models that reflect under models that reflect those four principles. They're all trying to improve care and lower costs. They're all trying to use information to improve the quality of care. They're all thinking like organizations that are capable of managing patients as populations and across time. And they're all, three of them are now participating under one of the shared savings or new payment models, and Grand Junction has been doing it for 20 years with their withholds for physicians. So I think we see in the movie the glimmers of the ways that healthcare reform, now moving forward, can start to improve U.S. healthcare. And I think we'll have a fun discussion about whether I've been smoking something for the last 5 years or maybe there is a possibility of change.
Carol?
Great. Well, thank you very much, and I'm so pleased and really honored to be here. I guess the perspective that I'd like to bring to complement the many things that we've learned from Elliot and his colleagues' work through the Dartmouth Atlas is to bring a little bit of a field perspective. So the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, where I work, was one of the early groups to formulate this notion of a three-part aim or a triple aim. You know, it was a new way for us to think about health system improvement, to consider health as part of the outcome, to consider per capita costs as part of our responsibility. We tended to put most of our emphasis in our early days into the quality of care and the experience of care corner of that triangle. And over the past 5 or 6 years, we've had an extraordinary opportunity to work with about 100 organizations and systems around the world, and about 70 of those, 65 to 70 of those in the United States, in all sorts of places that are working on exactly what you see depicted in the documentary. So one of the questions that I suspect will come up for people is the only fertile ground for this west of the Mississippi? Or, you know, are there places where some of these ideas are being tried that you know, would encompass the great variability and diversity of our country as a whole? And I would say to you the answer to that is yes. We have partners in New York City. We have partners in Washington, D.C. and Montgomery County right next to you. We have partners in North Carolina, in rural North Carolina. We have partners in Memphis, Tennessee. We have partners in Flint, Michigan. We have partners in Wisconsin. We have partners all over the place who are, I would say, a fairly self-selected group that are willing to look out into the future a little further, perhaps, than some, and who are taking action now to address the challenges that they see coming in the future. Whether how big a role healthcare reform would play or not play was not even on the table when they started. They started because they could see that it was something that the country needed. We needed to do better on all three dimensions, and they were willing to take a chance to try it out. And they saw opportunities within their own systems. Some of these systems are very traditional looking. They're pretty much integrated healthcare with a hospital and some office practices and maybe some outpatient surgeries in some nursing homes, and it's the usual kind of plain vanilla healthcare. Some of them also have health plans associated with them. Some of them are health plans. Some of them are employers. Some of them are regional coalitions, sometimes very grassroots safety net-based coalitions. So what we've been able to see is that there's a lot of will across the country in many, many, many places to try out ideas that the results of which would look very much like what you will see when you see the full documentary. When we think about change at IHI, we often think about three contributors to that: will, ideas, and execution. And I think that from where I sit, having had the privilege of working in the field with a lot of these organizations, there's a lot more will than we might perceive there to be. There's will in red states and blue states and rich places and poor places. There's a lot of will out there. And what I think we're beginning to accomplish now is the development of a set of ideas that can then be applied and adapted and embraced and improved upon that are usable, again, across a variety of situations and settings. And finally, I think this is the steepest climb, is how do you execute this stuff? And Elliot made reference to using the science of improvement and really using rigorous improvement methodologies. And I think we would say that probably the rate-limiting factor from where I sit is the capacity of systems to improve themselves. Having more supportive mechanisms for payment, having some regulatory tools available will help. But again, speaking from field experience here, I would say they're not sufficient in and of themselves to make the kind of changes that we need to make. So in the documentary, you will see a lot of examples of medical practitioners learning relentlessly every day from their current performance, from the performance of their peers, from their patients. And I think that that is really the challenge that we collectively will need to embrace to make the Grand Junctions and the group healths and the wonderful organizations portrayed more the norm.
Thank you. Mark?
Well, thanks. I just want to acknowledge the hard work that Elliot, Carol, the groups working with them have done to demonstrate how widely these kinds of changes can be made around the country. And special thanks to Tom for bringing it out in such a clear way. And I've never seen Dartmouth look better. Definitely never seen Elliot look better. So all world. all seems to be coming together
the
well.
The makeup guy was really
That's
good.
Right. But I want to emphasize a point about alignment, because this is hard work. There is a lot to do. You know, the principles are clear. And I think just about every clinician in medical practice, doctors, nurses, I mean, they want what's best for their patients. They want to avoid unnecessary costs. But one of the big frustrations in medical practice today is that it can be really hard to do that. And I think one reason you see so much variation here, and by the way, there also are a lot of variations in other countries too, which you can kind of see the same kind of relationships Absolutely. To some of the underlying financing and support, is that we don't make it easy for doctors and nurses and health professionals and patients and employers working with them to do the right thing, or we don't make it as easy as we could. And I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about that. One example of this came from that physician group practice demonstration that we started back in 2005 at CMS that Elliot mentioned, where a number of physician groups and organizations, including some represented here, had come to CMS and said, look, we're trying to do the right thing. We're trying to adopt electronic records to reduce duplicative services and get care well coordinated. We're trying to get out to our patients early about preventive, proven treatments to head off diseases and complications before they happen. We're really trying to focus in on our patients with chronic diseases through nurse managers and other support staff like those that you see in the documentary to help them understand their illness better and understand what they can do to prevent the complications. The problem is that we're getting killed. We're getting killed for two reasons. One is that none of those things I just described are paid for traditionally in Medicare or in any other health plan traditionally in the United States. And second is that to the extent that these things actually work, we get reimbursed less for the stuff that the health plans traditionally do pay for. And an upshot of that was what many of these organizations in the documentary had taken steps to accomplish earlier on, and that was to get some alignment between their financing policies and the support, the regulations in their environment, and what they were trying to accomplish in care. It doesn't necessarily mean you're not competing. It doesn't necessarily mean you need heavier kinds of regulation. It just means creating an environment that aligns what it is that physicians and other health professionals want, better care at a lower cost, with the way that health policies actually work. And there's some examples of that that came up in the documentary and that Elliot has already mentioned, examples like paying on the basis of an episode of care and paying more when there are fewer complications, when the patient gets back to work sooner, when overall costs are lower, and lower costs down the line too. Examples like accountable care organizations, examples like medical home payments that are also tied to some of these results in terms of better health and lower costs. This isn't necessarily easy for providers either. It does mean taking on some accountability for things that happen outside of those individual office visits, taking accountability for some of these improvements that can happen with patients, since resources are going to be tied to that, since that's what's going to be part of the measurement, you know, not just being paid based on volume and intensity, but being paid based on better results. But there are lots of examples of these kinds of things happening around the country. There also are examples on the patient or the consumer side. You know, one of the examples in Tom's documentary involved generic drugs, where giving providers information about use rates of generics led to some changes in their prescribing behavior. Well, health plans, including Medicare Part D plans, have also had some real success in doing that by, you know, here's an idea, letting the consumers save the money when they use the less expensive drug. You know, in most traditional insurance plans, if you switch from a brand to a generic, you might save a little bit. But under a lot of the plans that are now more popular in Part D, consumers get most of the savings and go from paying $70, $80 a month to a dollar in many Part D plans, and that's led to a huge shift in the use of generics among seniors. And if you think about where some health plans are headed now with other aspects of their benefit designs, it's not just something as simple as, you know, high deductible health care, but giving people with chronic illnesses a chance to save more money when they go to providers that are getting better results at a lower cost, when they take steps to use proven effective treatments for their diabetes and other conditions more effectively. These kinds of value-based insurance design approaches are reinforcing the changes that providers and consumers together would like to see to get to better health care at a lower cost. We are still a long way from solving these problems. And I think that's one reason you see so much of these variations persist here. Other countries, while they do have lower cost per capita, are also struggling with quality of care and efficiency issues and trying to move to systems there as well that get better alignment between our financing policies, our regulatory policies, and what it is the doctors and patients really want. I do want to emphasize the same point that Carol did, that very often lack of evidence is a real problem here. My hope and expectation from seeing how some of these steps have worked is that if you provide a more supportive environment for doctors and patients to do the right thing, then you do tend to get better data. But there are still more things that we can do to help get standard approaches to measuring quality, to help getting those measures out there in ways that patients can use in making decisions, not just about brands versus generic drugs as they're using today, but also about which place is really best for them to go to for their elective surgical procedures and maybe even for their care for their chronic diseases like diabetes. And that's something where I think we all still have a ways to go. But I want to agree in the end with something that Tom said, which is that the solutions here don't have to come from Washington. The leadership here really needs to come from people who know the most about where the opportunities are to improve care. And that's the doctors, the nurses, the health professionals, and the patients who are working with them. And as we continue to have debates about fixing the SGR problem and so forth in the short term, I'm really looking for and hopeful about more clinical leadership, more leadership from out there in the world of healthcare delivery to get this alignment to happen, to show that it can be done. We can get to better care and lower costs. We can measure it, and we can redesign our payment systems, our benefits, the environment for medical practice, so that these kinds of improvements in care, these kinds of really high-value approaches to care delivery aren't just an accident, a circumstance, something that people had to work hard to accomplish in isolation, but really do become much more systematic part of our healthcare system.
Thank you. Sean?
Thank you. And I want to thank Tom again for the documentary. I mean, with all the brain power up here, we are consistently reminded, ultimately, it's the storytellers who can really generate an impetus for change. And I think your work is part of that. I wanted to back up just a second and go to the budget, which is, anybody's been to the Nuff Kaiser events, you know we have a big federal deficit, and it's really driven by healthcare almost entirely. And that's true. I used to work at the state level. It's true of all the states as well. So we've got that situation, and that's going to change. We will fix the deficit problems ultimately. But there's two paths to fixing the changes. We can fix it as a budget problem and create more problems in the healthcare system, or we can fix the budget problems through improvement in the healthcare system and benefit both healthcare and the states and the federal government. And that's sort of the stark path that we're on. And I think some of the thinking behind a lot of the Affordable Care Act provisions and the creation of the Innovation Center. Echoing, and actually, Mark, you credited Tom Reed, but I think it was actually one of the deranged people in the supermarket who had said that the solutions weren't going to come from Washington, D.C. And we're trying to proceed very much on that premise, which is we're not trying to drive change and define change from the, at least at the Innovation Center, from the federal government. We're trying to find out where providers are and meet them where they are and help them get to where they're trying to go. Your documentary and the work of Dr. Fisher has shown there's plenty of people who have either figured it out or are working on figuring it out, want to figure it out. What they don't have is supportive payment systems that make a business case for them to pursue this. So we're trying to create those, and again, an array of those business cases, depending on where they are and how they want to move forward. Data, a lot of our models will involve intensive data sharing, Medicare claims data, which they haven't had previous access to, which speaks to what Elliot mentioned. Some change in expectations, both within our models, our specific new payment and delivery system models, but more broadly, public reporting and accountability, so you change the culture of what should we expect from the healthcare system. So you'll see a lot of that out of CMS. And again, the levers are many. CMS has some, and they're very powerful, but we need to align them with levers that other people are using. There's been a lot of focus. The Innovation Center has been blessed to be funded by $10 billion, and a lot of the people who come and meet with us talk about what we can do with you for part of the $10 billion. And our mantra has been, forget the $10 billion. Think of the $800 billion. Yeah. What do you want to do with the $800 billion differently than you're doing today? that could benefit you and us. You know, it's a couple more zeros. It's big money. And we have the ability to tweak how that goes out and test new payment models. And under the Affordable Care Act, if we prove a new payment and delivery system model works, the secretary can expand the scope of these demos and take them, in fact, to the national level. So those are the comments I wanted to make, and I look forward to the questions.
Thank you. Thank you all. Sean, the most interesting word in your title, I think, is innovation.
So not acting?
Maybe inside the beltway acting would get it, but we do have a nationwide audience for webcasting. In any case, fill us in a little bit about the Pioneer ACO models. What are the most interesting ideas you're seeing there? And as I understand it, another $1 billion may be going out the door at the end of March with the Innovation Challenge grants. What kinds of projects are coming to your office?
So first, thank you. On the Pioneer model, as you know, the Affordable Care Act created the Medicare Shared Savings Program, which is creating accountable care organizations that, based on a lot of the work of people in this panel, the notion is groups of providers, doctors, hospitals, lots of configurations can come together and accept accountability for the cost and quality of a defined population of Medicare beneficiaries. And in doing so, if they drive both improvement in quality but also generate cost savings, rather than, you know, tearing off their nose despite their face, they will actually benefit. CMS will share some of those savings with them. So trying to create a viable business model for this form of improvement. That's a permanent feature of the Medicare program now. At the Innovation Center, we wanted to sort of turbocharge that. We wanted to get out a little bit earlier with some of the leading organizations to really define we're putting them at higher risk, meaning if they generate savings, they get to keep a higher share of them. But on the flip side, if they don't, they can generate greater losses. And really have a vanguard of these organizations show how much change is really possible and set the standard. And also learn some things so that as we learn things from the Pioneer experience, we can gravitate those lessons into the permanent Medicare Shared Savings Program. And the second point you made was we have, in keeping with our philosophy of not defining change from Washington, our most recent initiative, we announced what's called the Healthcare Innovation Challenge, where we sort of threw it out to the public and said, here are our goals, which is improvement through cost reductions and quality improvements and creating a new, better workforce. You tell us how you'd like to do it. Come to us. We've got $1 billion to spend on these. We've gotten an overwhelming response. It's been really incredible. We are at the point where the applications were due back at the end of January, and end of March, early April, we'll be announcing the first round of those.
Are you able to describe at all kind of the most hopeful idea you've seen?
No, for two reasons. One, they're going through a technical review now, so I haven't even seen them. And two, just federal contracting rules, we're not allowed to talk about the nature of these. But this is all very rapid cycle. They will be public in the springtime, so it's not like, you know, waiting a year.
We've heard so far a lot of different ideas for new models. Mark, is there one single definition that everyone agrees is a description of an accountable care organization, or are there are lots of different projects under that big umbrella?
Well, I don't know if there's a definition that everyone agrees with. I think, as Elliot pointed out, there's some key features that include this focus on better results at a lower cost measurably for a population of patients, and then the features of the care delivery drive getting to that. You know, it's not, you know, we're not focused on a specific doctor hospital structure so much as we're focused on what works best in the particular community for getting those better results for patients. So there are some capabilities I think others have fleshed out that seem to go along well with that. I would just emphasize that the goal here, and Sean pointed this out, is that, you know, look, not, at least pointed this out implicitly, I think, that not every healthcare provider, in fact, the vast majority of healthcare providers in this country are not part of fully integrated organizations, and yet there are still a lot of opportunities for them to coordinate care better, to work in new ways with, if they're primary care doctors, to work with specialists, to work with hospitals, post-acute care providers, to take a more systematic and comprehensive accountability for getting better results for their patients. And there are a lot of payment reforms that can help move in that direction. I would call all of those, in some sense, moving in the direction of accountable care. The accountable care organizations are kind of the most comprehensive approach to that, where you've got an identifiable organization taking responsibility for getting better results and lower cost trends for a population of patients, being able to measure it, being able to deliver on it. And that's I think those are the key features.
In your opening comments, you talked about the need for real evidence. Does this work in terms of saving money and delivering better care? How many years away are we from that point of knowing whether these new models work? What I'm getting at is, are we at the beginning of the beginning?
Well, hopefully we're past the beginning of the beginning, and Elliot should comment on this too,
yeah.
But there are a number of organizations that have implemented these kinds of reforms and are doing well with them. As you heard, some of the communities or some of the groups in the documentary were already doing something like this. You know, this notion of what they called in Grand Junction a withhold based on quality and cost. The money left over at the end of the year would go to the providers. That's the same idea of shared savings, meaning you get paid more not when you do more procedures or have more complications, but when you get better results at a lower cost for your patients. And what that is, it's not really about profit so much for these physician groups. I mean, they're kind of barely making ends meet, but it means they've got more resources they can spend on the stuff that really matters for patients, like spending extra time with the ones who need it, like implementing electronic records or paying that nurse manager in a way that Medicare otherwise wouldn't reimburse. So, you know, I think there's plenty of evidence that these approaches can work, and for some of the newer ACOs, like in Blue Cross of Massachusetts and some of the private plans like Cigna and Aetna that have implemented some of these steps already with physician groups, in some of the physician group practice demonstration programs, you know, they're achieving at least 1 or 2 or more % off spending growth per year. And if you look at those charts that Sean alluded to with the budget, if we can bring down healthcare spending growth overall by a couple of percent per year, that would go a long way towards taking care of the longer-term fiscal problems that we're facing. So the evidence is emerging. I think not all of these are going to be successful, and hopefully we're going to be learning a lot more and more quickly about what's working and what's not and how to help get this alignment and support providers in doing what's right.
There are just two things I'd want to add. First, the evidence, early evidence from the alternative quality contract, which is the ACO model in Massachusetts, you know, global payment under a fee-for-service model with strong quality incentives, is very promising. So they've shown that they can improve. They've all improved quality a lot. They're improving. They are bending the cost curve primarily initially by shifting patients from high-cost hospitals to other hospitals. But the interesting thing is that it's not only succeeding in those places that have adopted, but everybody else is wanting to join. So that now 70% of the physicians, I think, in the Blue Cross network that are participating under Blue Cross in Massachusetts are choosing to join the alternative quality contract. So it's people are speaking with their feet in trying to join this new payment model. I think the second thing that I want to say is that we see incredible diversity in the kinds of organizations that are stepping forward to try to play in this new under this new payment model. Mark and I have been working with 5 sites around the country in the Brookings Dartmouth pilots that started a few years ago to join with a private payer to pilot these models. And they're very diverse systems, from a fully integrated delivery system in Carilion, you know, in Virginia, out to Tucson Medical Center, which is, you know, associated with a group of completely independent practitioners. And all of those, across that diversity of models, you see people figuring out how to do this. It is hard work to do the improvement work. You know, they have to figure out how they're going to get a hold of the data. It took Grand Junction a few years to figure out how to put the data systems in place and feed them back to the docs. So I think we're beyond the beginning, but I think we have strong evidence that it could work, and we have to learn as quickly as we can how to make the models work even better. We will have trouble as long as providers are in these complicated mixed models, so that it's very hard to do global payment, you know, for your Medicare population and everybody else's fee-for-service. Then you're going to have a hard time changing your organization.
I have a very basic question that I was left wondering about after watching Tom's documentary and hearing the four of you speak, and that is,
How is quality defined? How is it measured? And who makes those decisions? How do we know that people in Grand Junction or Seattle, for example, are healthier for being a part of these new models?
Well, maybe I could take a first crack at that. When we speak about quality and we speak about the experience of care, we're really talking about kind of two facets. One is those things that research tells us are best. You know, we take our guidance from the Institute of Medicine. So is it safe? Is it effective? Is it patient-centered, timely, equitable, and efficient? Is it all of those things that we have, many of us have kind of used as our North Star for some years since the Institute of Medicine released its influential report? The other side of that is subjectively. You know, how does it feel to me? Do I have access when I think I need it? Do I get care from people that know something about me? You know, that know something about my needs and preferences, that know something about my circumstances. So we think about that in the experience corner. And what we're starting to see with some of our partners is that as the reliability of care gets better, so we have one of the partners we've worked a lot with and learned a lot from is Health Partners in Minneapolis, Minnesota area. And they have really gotten their diabetic care to a highly reliable level. If you are a diabetic in their system, you are they're getting closer and closer to perfect reliability. And what they can see is on those clinical measures, did we do all the stuff we were supposed to do? Yes. Increasingly, the answer to that is yes, we did everything. But they can also see it in reduced heart attack rates. So their heart attack rates are down by 2/3. Their amputations are down. Their instances of blindness and retinopathy are down. So you can start to see the impact of that in things that actually matter to the health of patients. You saw some glimpses of that in the documentary where the gentleman from Boeing said, I used to be in the high-risk pool, and I'm not anymore because I actually got that. I got my issues dealt with successfully, so I'm not at that kind of high risk any longer. So I think increasingly it is, we do find that there's a little bit of a culture, you know, difference in culture. The public health folks are used to talking about population health and burden of disease and life expectancy and healthy life expectancy and quality adjusted life years and all of these sorts of measures that are not yet common currency. We don't yet have as much of a shared language as we need between the medical side and the public health side, but those measures do exist. And to be able to bring forth both the scientifically validated practices that represent quality, it's the subjective experience of can I get care that meets my needs, and then something about what's your actual health status. So we have systems that are saying the health status of our collection of people, our population, is either stabilizing, it's not getting worse, you know, as people age and as they deal with their diseases, or in some cases it's getting better. So I think that we're in the early days of becoming very facile and very comfortable with those sets of measures, but the measures do exist and they are being used.
Sean, could you take that question? I mean, just the other day on Kaiser Health News, there was an article about teaching hospitals objecting to some of the quality measures and whether they were truly representative and told the whole story of what was going on in these institutions.
Well, so measurement of quality is as complicated as defining the quality. And as Carol said, we've in the Pioneer program and in the ACO program generally tried to follow a lot of those different things that the IOM has identified and measure and care about many facets of quality. You asked an earlier question, are we at the beginning of the beginning? In quality measurement, we're definitely not at the beginning of the beginning. We're worlds ahead of where we were 10 years ago, and I think it's going to just explode even further. So I don't think we're going to end up, but we're in a pretty good place, I think, and we're far ahead of. I used to work for the state of Maryland as a hospital regulator back in as recently as the late 90s, and we regulated the price of hospital care. And the hospitals came in and used to say, but you should be measuring us on quality, too. And we'd all look around and start laughing because we knew that was impossible, and it was sort of a smokescreen. They were throwing it. We didn't know what quality was. And, you know, consider where we are today, where, first of all, the Maryland rate system does measure them on quality and fairly sophisticated measures. So I think we're in a pretty good place, but I also think measurement of quality is really going to explode.
I want to tackle two more issues before I open it up to the audience. One has to do with the cultural impediments to forming the kinds of organizations we've been discussing. I was talking to a colleague a few days earlier preparing for this event, and she said, doctors are cowboys. They don't want to be corralled. They don't want to be organized. So, Carol, I would ask you,
what are the cultural issues that would make creating a Grand Junction in other parts of the country really hard?
Well, I'm not sure that I've seen it be as hard as you might be suggesting. And
okay.
I think part of the reason for that, and it's well depicted in the documentary, is that so much of what we're talking about really relies on fulfilling the potential of primary care to do a very great job at taking care of the whole person, anticipating their needs, dealing with them over time. I'm not sure that the cowboy label is fairly applied. The folks that we deal with day in and day out, many of them sort of operating within primary care, but really across specialties, they, once they get the system to start performing in a way that really serves patients well, that really allows them to deliver the kind of care that they intended to deliver when they were growing up and decided to go into medicine, what we find is that this kind of work can lead to skyrocketing levels of what we would at the Institute would call joy in work. So there is an astounding consistency to what people say. It's like, oh, now I get to do the kind of medicine that I always wanted to do. Now I'm not all tied up in, you know, 5-minute appointments that don't, that barely scratch the surface of the needs that I see before me.
Do you hear that from specialists?
Yes, we do, in the sense that a lot of specialty care, and we've worked a bit with some of the veterans health organizations on this, and their experience was that a lot of stuff that was getting referred to specialty care was fairly simple stuff that didn't really need to go there. And one of the things they did that we thought was quite innovative was to pair up their primary care doctors with their specialists and really skill up the primary care doctors so that the more routine, more manageable issues wouldn't have to be referred in. And so that the specialists could do what the specialists do best, which is take care of the really hairy, complicated stuff. So I don't know that specialists get a great deal of gratification dealing with stuff that could have already been dealt with by somebody else in a simpler fashion. So I do think that there are a lot of, from the point of view of professional satisfaction and professional growth, there are some real upsides here.
Elliot? Yeah,
and we saw certainly in our, you know, we had a social psychologist with us on our pilot site visits to the Brookings Dartmouth ACO pilots. And one of the things she observed was among a group of completely autonomous cowboys out west in Tucson, you know, they would have been happily labeled as cowboys. There emerged, they were completely autonomous, they felt their identity was as individual practitioners, but what emerged was a shared identity of collaborating to improve care and the quality. So part of their shared identity was as independent practitioners trying to work together to improve the quality of care. So it's very much what Carol says. I think there is a, you know, there is, people want to do the right thing. They have not been in systems, whether payment or delivery systems, that allow them to do so.
Okay. Mark, I want to talk about finances with you. There was a back and forth among three experts, including Don Berwick and Tom Scully, a while ago in the Wall Street Journal, and they were debating what the cost is of launching an ACO, and the prices were from $10 million to $35 million. And it was an impossible obstacle to get past for some solo practices, certainly, for small group practices. Why is it that expensive, number one? And what kind of impediments does that put in front of some providers? Does it give hospitals, for example, the leg up in forming ACOs?
Well, no question that there is some investment required to do the kinds of changes that we've been talking about today. It means not only maybe investing in some IT equipment, and by the way, a lot of those pilot sites got going with something far less than a fully integrated electronic medical record, just some basic capabilities online of tracking where patients with common illnesses were getting care and making sure, you know, helping them make sure they were getting the best care. So it's not necessarily a huge amount of money, but it does take some time and effort for the providers who need to work together in new ways to get together, to identify those opportunities for improvement, and then to implement the changes together to make it happen. So no question, this is an investment. Sources of paying for those investments can be some of the programs that Medicare and private insurers are implementing. That Blue Cross of Massachusetts program that Elliot mentioned included some significant upfront support, both financially for especially primary care practices and in kind in terms of providing the kind of data that I was just describing that can help the practitioners know where they need to direct their efforts to reach the goals. So it can come from health plans. A number of hospitals are making investments in support for smaller groups. CMS has tried to start some programs that are more targeted to small physician practices, and I think those are good steps. I think there's probably more that can be done to align a lot of different programs that are out there now. If you're a physician in independent practice, you're reporting on a variety of quality measures. You've got an opportunity to participate in health IT payments. You've got an opportunity to participate in a range of other pilots, as well as the MSSP program. I think more steps that can kind of align those in terms of the measures, in terms of the requirements, and so forth, are all going to be helpful as well. So it is work, but there are more opportunities coming for physicians to be able to overcome that, not just through working with hospitals, but through working with health plans, certainly private plans and Medicare, and a number of groups are getting some equity funding for their kinds of investments in these activities too. There also are community-based programs, so lots of resources out there, and this is a plug for some of the stuff that we do at Brookings and Dartmouth. We're trying to help physicians and other smaller clinical practices see how they can take advantage of that to make these changes in their practice.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to open it up now to questions from all of you. There are two women on either side with microphones. Wait until the mic gets in your hand. Stand up, tell us who you are, what organization you represent, and what your question is. And if any of you have a question for Tom, he will jump right back up at the podium. So somebody raise their hand. Right there.
Brett Anderson, actually part of Booz Allen and the new healthcare delivery science program up at Dartmouth that Elliot's part of. Question is, I guess, for the entire panel, as we pull up from the PGP demo and we look at the results of those 5 or 6 years, it seemed as though there were some places like the University of Michigan that did very well. They achieved some shared savings throughout the entirety of the program. Others, like the Billings Clinic, that really didn't. And then there's some kind of in the middle, like Dartmouth-Hitchcock, that did in some years, didn't in others. I'm wondering, as you guys talked about really learning about what we see as success factors, are we also learning about what, are the potential potholes that ACOs are also encountering and things that they should then avoid as they, kind of start up and try to achieve those shared savings?
Good question. Elliot, you want to start?
Well, I can speak directly to the Dartmouth issue since I've been part of some of the conversations inside Dartmouth, Dartmouth-Hitchcock, about why we stumbled. They believe it was a lack of attention to the consistently paying attention to the issues of chronic illness care. So they got a bunch of care managers, they put them in the primary care practices, they started to reorganize primary care practice, and then they got distracted. The care managers started to pay attention to other things, like filling out prescriptions for the docs who were busy and didn't want to pay attention to them and get distracted from the care management work. So I think focus was one of the things that one saw in that program. And I think one of the questions that we all have, that many people within the Beltway have worried about with pilots is as soon as it's seen as a short-term initiative that might go away in 3 years, there's not much reason to really make that substantial investment that may be required to make fundamental changes. So I think it's one of the things is making sure we try to align it so it's multiple initiatives that are lined up, and Dartmouth for themselves had just one payer who was participating in this and everybody else was fee-for-service. And the second is, let's try to get a consistent long-term goal that people know they're going to be heading toward for a while and not have them feel that the rug is going to get pulled out from under them if they start to make some changes. And we're, I think the variation across systems, we really do need much more of a case study. I would love to have, 10 policy teams go in and say, let's see if we can figure out why it worked in this place and not. The danger of what we're doing now is we are starting this experiment with lots of private payer ACOs and Medicare, the Medicare Shared Savings Program. And as I understand it, Medicare's investment in the evaluation is going to focus only on the Innovation Center demonstrations, not on the Medicare Shared Savings Program. We're missing the opportunity to learn from the private sector ACO activities. And we may not even learn a lot from the Medicare Shared Savings Program. And we would be wise to invest in that learning so we can actually instead of guess and one anecdote about Dartmouth, we get a few more systematic points of data.
Carol?
Yeah, I would, not knowing the details of how each of the participating pilot organizations fared on that, I just make one comment about the design of this, which is that it's a big challenge to learn quickly as you go, but a three-year learning cycle, you know, to figure out if something worked or not is kind of a long time. So what one of the design ideas that we might take forward is to figure out, you know, how much could we learn in the first 6 months and the second, or even in the first month and the second month and the third, so that our learning systems and our evaluation systems are geared for faster detection of outcomes plus or minus. And I think one of the things that I've learned in doing improvement work at IHI, and I think that we teach others, is that sometimes the failed test teaches you a lot more than the successful one. So the idea of looking at the failed tests, I think, is a crucial challenge and a vital activity to take on for the advancement of the towards the aims.
Is there a question on this side? Yes, up here in the third row.
Hi, Paul Cotton with the National Committee for Quality Assurance. Excellent panel, and I can't wait to see your full documentary. It looks awesome. My question has to do with, you had talked about how the payment systems haven't been really supporting delivery system reforms. We seem to have an opportunity now in that Congress is once again trying to do what they call the doc fix and reform the Medicare physician payment system. Is it time now for Congress to step up and ensure that there are rewards in the payment system for patient-centered medical homes and ACOs?
Mark?
Yeah, I think so, and I've been saying that for a while. I had an opportunity to testify again this past year with the Energy and Commerce Committee on the SDR, and I went back and looked at my testimony from, you know, 3 years ago, 5 years ago, and sort of the same thing. That there, and this is a tough problem because physicians are facing an urgent crisis. I mean, we can't have, you know, 20-30% reduction in payments happening as a cliff and expect there not to be any impact on access. And there is not as much evidence as we'd like on how different kinds of payment systems for physicians would really impact longer-term costs. That said, based on a lot of the work that we and collaborators are doing, I think there are now far more examples around the country than there used to be of physicians getting paid differently and getting both demonstrably better results and savings. And this applies, you know, not just in primary care, where approaches like medical homes, I think, by the way, importantly linked to some, you know, I mentioned that word accountability before, so medical homes that involve more payments for IT systems and processes of care are good, but I think if you really want to see an impact, the ones that have had a bigger effect have also had some accountability for actually using those tools to get to measurable improvements in patient outcomes, fewer complications, and lower overall costs. We've been a bit behind that on the specialty side, but there are a lot of examples there too. We were talking about specialists earlier. You know, we've been working with some oncology practices around the country that in traditional Medicare reimbursement, fee-for-service, have the bulk of their practice revenues coming from the chemo and radiation services that they administer. They don't particularly like to be paid that way. I mean, they want to make sure that their patients get the appropriate treatments that they need, but they'd like to have more support for things like spending time with patients, going over a care plan and expectations, being able to manage patients more effectively outside the hospital to maybe head off an emergency room visit or an admission, things that, you know, as we've talked about in primary care, not reimbursed for specialists very well either. And companies like health plans like United are now implementing programs with some success that are changing that are tying payments more to what the oncologists say they want to be paid for, having some accountability for results, showing that the patients are getting, you know, more, not less, evidence-based care and are having fewer complications. So we may not have a solution for the whole country, but I think something that Congress could consider right now is at least opening up an opportunity for physicians who are moving into these new payment systems that have a demonstrable impact on quality and cost to have some reward and support for doing that, rather than just doing a simple another simple extension of kicking the SGR can down the road. I think if you look kind of across the board, I mentioned oncology, but you know, orthopedics, cardiology, nephrology, as well as primary care, there are lots of examples of that I think are ripe to get that kind of support from payment reform.
I don't want to take off my Dartmouth hat completely here. I think there's another policy prescription that ought to be thought about, which is that we ought to be thinking about withholds rather than cuts. You know, the same thing that you can achieve through cuts, you can do through a withhold, except the withhold creates, just as it did in Grand Junction, an incentive for the docs to start thinking differently about how they're practicing. And whether it's, you know, I would also think it should be done at a global level, so the withhold is from hospitals as well as from physicians. And it's at a regional level, which gives them some encouragement to stop the local medical arms race, which is bankrupting our children. So John Skinner and Jim Weinstein and I wrote something in JAMA that I'd encourage you to take a look at. I think it's, you know, we ought to be talking about how to get the incentives lined up to get physicians and hospitals moving together, and this SGR fix is a perfect opportunity to start those conversations.
There's a question over here, and until the mic gets here, I wanted to ask a quick question of Sean, though you may be a little bit constrained in answering it, and maybe somebody else on the panel can. And that is, late next month, of course, the Supreme Court is going to have 3 days of hearings about the Affordable Care Act. What are your worries or hopes in terms of a ruling and how that may affect what's in the pipeline regarding the ACOs? Is there a plan B, for example, if the court strikes the law down?
So I will answer this extremely narrowly.
I thought you might.
And I'm not a lawyer. I know at least some of the challenges are not related to many of the payment and delivery system changes. I mean, the primary challenge is to the underlying mandate. And so we're supportive of the Affordable Care Act in its entirety, but I think we don't perceive the Innovation Center and the types of changes we're trying to make as a primary target.
Although some of the money is being funded through the ACA.
Correct.
A lot of it.
Yes.
So.
Right, so if it was struck down in its entirety, but again, I go back to my introductory remarks. You know, you could take away the $10 billion, we still have the $800
billion. Yes.
But don't take away the $10
billion. Hi, I'm Joanne Lin. I'm the director of the Center for Elder Care and Advanced Illness at Altarum Institute. And I was noticing a really interesting shift between the documentary and the conversation. The documentary was using almost all the term, this community did whatever, you know, and all kinds of good things. And the conversation has been doctors, hospitals, and insurers can do X, Y, or Z. And I wanted to call you back a little to thinking some about whether, at least for some populations and at least for some of the things we need to tackle, that may be an unfortunate shift. That, you know, as I go around to other countries, every other country has a local integrator that involves social services, hospital-type services, and supportive services of the medical type in the community. Now I'm working mainly in elder care, so you know, it's people who are very, very sick, and you know, kind of the fate of most of us as we get very old of having multiple conditions that include some social services issues and some medical services issues, and they're very expensive. But we almost undercut the possibility of there being local action by our antitrust rules, by our concerns over competition, by the mental model. Elliot was talking about a mental model of face-to-face, but there's also a mental model that kind of underscores the cowboy approach and denigrates any collaborative work locally. And yet, you know, there's nothing more localizing than being very sick and old. No one goes to Mayo for spoon feeding. You're actually tied to where you live. And should we deliberately try to enhance what the documentary was seeing as community action and at least try out the elbow room of giving the communities a little bit of rope to manage their own system, which would mean data that actually reflects population well-being and personal care plans and so forth that reflect a balance of what the community can provide and what the people really face.
Carol,
do you want to take this? Community, a missing piece.
Yeah, thank you.
I'd be delighted. And we've had the good fortune of having some great help from Joanne on some of the learning that we've been doing at the Institute around regional approaches. It's true that you go into sort of terra incognito because there aren't ready-made institutions that generally are doing this work, but there are places where coalitions and collaboratives are coming together. So one of them is right next to here in Montgomery County. There's a kind of grassroots coalition that's come together to really serve underinsured and uninsured individuals systemically that has medical care and social care and all sorts of stuff stitched together in a kind of resourceful, scrappy kind of way. We're doing some work in central Michigan in a dozen or so counties centered on Saginaw, Michigan, and really the catalyst for a lot of that has been one of the big employers in the area, Dow Chemical. But this collaboration includes the health system and the public health system and the mental health system and the businesses and the insurers. And one of the things that they're interested in and one of the things that motivates them to come together across sectors is the feeling that in Michigan, they're striving for an economy that has enough vitality and enough health in it that the kids that grow up there could possibly stay and have a life, and to prevent or avoid the fate where healthcare takes so much of the wealth of the community that other opportunities are impaired. We see similar work going on in Memphis, where there's a great deal of interest in catalyzing the faith community to be an active part of health promotion and to really be detecting health problems out in the community long before the healthcare system may ever even be aware of them. So we are seeing some of these, but I think Joanne's point is good. We don't have ready-made institutions. So there is some experimentation going on here, but there's a long way to go to really learn what it's going to take.
Can I say couple of hopefully quick things about this? One is there are, as Carol said, some community level examples, and it's kind of interesting to watch how they've evolved. So one I'll give is the Indiana Health Information Exchange, which started out as one of kind of the leading early efforts to share data across different healthcare providers. They found that model was very difficult to sustain financially for all the reasons that we've talked about before. So they are now funded in part by the same shared savings approach, where they have now a multi-payer payment system in place that includes Medicare as well as WellPoint and Medicaid and the state employees program, where they are getting paid in part for improving outcomes at the community level for a wide range of patients and a wide range of conditions, heart disease, diabetes, and so forth. And that's helped. It hasn't solved. It has helped with their problem of sustainability. And they're not just about IT anymore. It's really evolved into more of an effort to identify the biggest gaps in public health at the community level. They've had some particular problems in diabetes and getting patients with diabetes into just basic coordinated care that they focused on in the short term, and that seems to be making a difference. But I also wanted, as Joanne well knows, when we talk about problems of coordination and quality, the biggest problems are not with only the patients with diabetes, although those are significant problems, but the patients who have multiple chronic conditions and are frail. And I think there's a fragmentation problem when you care for diabetes. I mean, just think about it for someone who's dually eligible for Medicare and Medicaid and is not only in fee-for-service or fragmented payment systems, but actually in different payment systems. They do not coordinate well, and is a horrible set of quality of care problems for these patients. And for those of you who have cared for a parent who's going through Alzheimer's and the different conditions that go along with it, you know this because nobody is there, not nearly enough is there to help you and help them get the care that they need, which is often just about supporting good quality of life, that basic stuff that that Joanne was mentioning. It's not high tech, but it's not being done very well in our care system. And this goes back to an earlier discussion we had about the quality measures, and I do think we have some real gaps there still. I mean, one of them is in this area of risk adjustment that some of the providers that have perhaps a more significant share of high-risk patients feel like aren't adequately addressed in some of our administrative data systems now. Hopefully we'll keep making progress on that. But another problem is just having the measures of quality that patients really care about. And one of the biggest gaps in those areas is for these patients with frailty, where, you know, even though we're making progress on ACO implementation and the like, and there's some good measures included in the Pioneer program and the MSSP program, we don't have great measures for particularly this kind of patient population. We don't have good measures for, you know, do you have a plan of care in place? Is it being followed? Are you getting the care that you want? And those kinds of things are very important obstacles to making more progress on high quality and low cost that the public can have confidence in.
Is there a question over here? John?
My name is John Donnelly, and I want to identify myself actually through Tom. We are members of the same Kaiser Journalism Fellowship class of 2007, 2008.
A journalist.
Under the artful direction of Penny Duckham, which we are internally grateful for. And I'm so happy, Tom, to see that that your book and your film from that year also led to the film here today. Is that right?
Yeah.
So that's a pretty amazing follow-on in the Kaiser Fellowship. So my question, obviously, is to you, Tom. So you talked about, in the film, four different cases that were quite different to show that there's all this innovation happening around the country. I'm interested in commonalities. If you saw anything on the commonalities of the instigators, of the catalysts, of the people who really got these things going, and I wonder if that kind of approach, if any kind of approach, should actually target this group of people, or maybe it's a combination of, maybe it's a community that has many different players working to the same goal. But I wonder if looking at the communities, as you were saying, is a way to sort of advance this at a quicker rate.
Tom, do you want to go back up to the podium? And while you do, I did want to recognize someone in the audience, Barbara Terhern from Group Health in Seattle, is here and may want to make a few comments after Tom. Go ahead. Very good.
Got it. We asked everybody, if you see our movie, you'll see, we asked everybody, how do you do this? What does it take? And Elliot telegraphed it at the beginning of the movie. We just saw him. He said, there are doctors who've decided that they not only have to worry about the physical health of their patients, but also the fiscal health of their communities. And regardless of the system or the structure or the size of the city, east, west, north, or south, we found docs who actually said that to us. I cost too much, and I've got to get costs down. We went to a hospital. I love this. We went to this hospital in Everett, Washington, the Providence Hospital. It was the Sisters of Providence who started it. They walked across the continent from Montreal to Puget Sound and opened a bunch of hospitals, driven by the mission to care for the needy people in those communities. And 110 years later, I'm in the lobby of the Providence Hospital talking to this 44-year-old Jewish man who's the CEO of the hospital, and he says, I got to keep my costs down because I have to care for the neediest people in my community. He still had that mission. So I think that was common everywhere we went, was a sense of obligation to worry about costs as well as quality and access. And then the other thing is, everybody agreed on this. Every time I went to, they said, you got to have a leader. So you take these doctors in Grand Junction, Colorado, they make probably 15 to 20% less than a doctor in the same specialty in some other city in Colorado or across the border in Utah. So why do you do that? Well, Dr. Herb made us do it. There's a leader in that community and said, you want to practice medicine here? You're welcome. It's a great place to live. And by the way, we're going to withhold 20% of your fee and pay it to you if you're doing good work. The leader kind of required it. So it takes a sort of a sense of commitment to the community. We found that in common everywhere. And we found everywhere a leader who was driving this sense.
Tom, I'm not sure about the research you did ahead of time, you and Lisa, I should say. But did you talk to hospital officials who said, this isn't for me, this isn't for us, this isn't right for our community? And what were their reasons?
They make more if they don't keep their costs down. Here's the deal.
But they would, my guess is they would also say to you, I care about my patients. I care about costs.
Oh, there's an, but I can't get costs down, you mean? Look, the thing is, we focused on the good news in American healthcare. I almost thought that title was ironic, U.S. Healthcare, the Good News. But there is good news in U.S. healthcare. It's in our film. But there's also bad news. I mean, there are counties, there are, what do you call them, hospital
referral regions
that cost way more to treat the same ailment as Grand Junction or Seattle. And we didn't go to the bad guys. We were original. The original plan would be go to see some low-cost places and see some high-cost places and see what the difference is. And I think there were probably two reasons we didn't. We ran out of time. If you do a movie on PBS, it's an hour-long movie, but they come on at the beginning and say, PBS is great, please send money. And then at the end, they say, wasn't this a great movie, please send more money. And we get 52 or 53 minutes. We ran out of time, and we also ran out of money. We didn't have enough money to go to all the places we would have might have gone to. So we just focused on the good news. But we had a showing like this in Manhattan a couple weeks ago. And a guy from a very notoriously high-cost hospital in Manhattan was there, and he said, this movie should never be shown on TV. It's outrageous. The very idea that the things those other towns are doing, I could do in this very, very difficult setting of healthcare in Manhattan, Manhattan Island, New York, New York. It's just too hard. And I think that's the general attitude. Gee, that's really interesting that these innovators have seen these ideas, but we couldn't make it work here. It's too hard. My argument is we could. They could do it. New York could do it if they had that sense of community and a leader to drive them, as we found in the other communities.
Thank you. Is there a question on this side, towards the back there?
Can I just supplement that? I mean, there is a New York institution that has probably the most poverty-ridden, disease-ridden population in the country, in the Bronx, that thinks they can do it. They're in a pioneer ACO.
Yeah, I was just going to, absolutely.
Its name?
And the New York City Health and Hospitals Corporation, the public system, has been very, very active in this. So again, I think it is a little risky to just kind of imply that a worse regional result means that everybody in that region is, you know, out of touch and not doing their job. Often there are really great bright spots, even in a region that has high cost.
I should give a shout out.
Well, it gets to an issue that we were Penny and I were talking about with Elliot last week, and that is cynicism from many different sources. And the idea, the worry that, the legitimate worry, I think, that this is the latest thing. This is, I read somewhere, HMO and drag. You know, that ACOs are HMO and drag is what I read from one critic or one skeptic. And that has to serve be another impediment in developing these models.
It's really important that people understand the differences between the old HMOs and the new ACOs. I mean, the old model was put all the risk on the docs. The new model is shared risk and thoughtful actuarial models. The old model, you know, was no quality measurement. You know, the new model is quality measurement.
And patients have more flexibility.
And the old model was lock them in, and the new one is choice. So it's a very different approach with the underlying principles that let's try to improve care and achieve lower costs the same.
Yes.
Yes, I just wanted to mention that, you know, in listening to you, it strikes me how much electronic health records and information technology is just sort of the backbone of this. And
can
I'd
you
like
hold it
to
a little
hear
closer?
Panelists describe your impressions of have we made the adequate advancement and sort of are there standards out there and is will this be a hindrance to making this initiative, these initiatives kind of move forward in terms of widespread IT adoption and standardized practices in terms of quality?
Mark and Sean, do you want to take that?
Yeah, I guess I've got kind of mixed views, and maybe the best way to reconcile them is to, like my emphasis would be that health IT is an enabler. It's a tool that can be used to help support these goals along with a whole lot of other necessary steps, like spending the time, like looking at the practice and looking at the opportunities for improvement. And IT can obviously help provide the data and the timely information to impact all of that. But I wouldn't get too hung up on IT for its own sake. And as I mentioned, some of the groups that we've worked with have been able to make a good deal of progress with something far less than a fully integrated electronic record. I think what a number of our pilot sites have done is taken a sort of a stepwise approach to this, where they make some investments in improving IT that, and then make some more the next year and some more the next year. But the key thing with each of the steps is they're tied to some specific goals that go beyond IT for its own sake. You know, we have a problem in delivering care to diabetics, or in coordinating care for patients with heart failure, or in some aspect of our preventive services. And the foremost focus is on solving those problems, and IT is part of the strategy to get there. I do think that the IT investments so far are making a difference. I mean, it's clearly been a lot more take-up in the last couple of years in conjunction with the meaningful use regulations. I guess I'm still concerned that even with more take-up, there's still a lot of limitations on the ability of those systems to communicate in a timely way across different providers. And so within providers, they're clearly better, but a lot of the problems that we're facing are between, you know, the specialists working with the primary care doctors, each of them working with the hospital, all of them working with the community-based providers that are delivering long-term and supportive services, and I don't know that we've solved those problems with the IT systems that are on the shelf right now.
Okay. Barbara Treharn in the front row, do you want to say a few words about the experience of group health in Seattle? I hope I'm not putting you on the spot. A mic will come down to the first row here, and I hope I pronounced your last name correctly.
The only thing I would say is this notion of community and leadership in the organization. And two things. One, our medical director, Dr. Michael Soman, who was in the film, was really our champion for the medical home model. And initially, a lot of us said, yeah, sure. But he persisted, and we all persisted together and successfully implemented across 25 primary care clinics this model. But more importantly, have used a lot of lean methodology to really focus on the continuous improvement. And so this notion of really sticking with it month after month after month, really looking at our measures and our metrics and being able to say, are they telling us what we need to know? And are they giving us the information? Are our providers getting the information that they need in order to make their own improvement at the individual level as well as at their local clinic level and then beyond? So the leadership component is important. The other thing I think, excuse me, that's really important is not just community within the organization and outside the organization, but it is really the spirit of pioneering. And so I was saying earlier to someone, we're our own worst critics. We constantly look at ourselves and say, we're not good enough. We really have to be better. And so there's something about the sense of pioneering. We were formed over 60-some years ago, actually, by people in the community who came together because healthcare costs too much in our community. And our original physicians who joined our organization were actually outlawed in our community by the medical organizations and were thrown out and all of that. So we come from a strong sense of a pioneering spirit that has really persisted. But people who come to the organization, I think, get a pretty clear message about what that really means. And so it permeates the environment. I think it makes a huge difference. And I think the ability to have the data that does tell us that we are doing a better job for our patients, not just at the individual level, but at the population-based level as well.
Okay. We're going to have to wrap up in a moment. I want to give the final word to Mark McClellan. The question. What I want to ask is, hope and expectation are very different things. What is your expectation about what you will be able to say about everything we've been discussing today in 3 years?
I think that we're going to see a lot more progress. I mean, I'm reasonably optimistic, and part of that stems from pessimism. You were talking about earlier some of the some of the lack of evidence of these systems working and the like, the pressure to find a better alternative is just going to keep increasing. You know, what I've seen over the last few years is a lot more physicians, nurses, healthcare providers, employers stepping up to take on some of these challenges because they see the alternative approaches aren't working. You can kind of see that happening more with the current, say, SGR debate, where there are going to be, if we don't solve these problems, the fiscal pressures are not going to go away. There are going to be more squeezes down on prices. There are going to be more problems with access potentially across the board, certainly for more vulnerable patients, but affecting everybody. And there are these big gaps in the quality of care that patients are getting. There's this big gap between the care that many providers would like to deliver and what they feel like they're able to deliver in the current system, with an era that should be headed towards much more personalized medicine, much more of a prevention orientation. That's where science is taking us. These kinds of reforms really have the sort of across-the-board momentum behind them, fiscal momentum, technological momentum, and they're in line with what providers and patients really want. So it won't be easy. There will be a lot of stumbles along the way. All of these programs, and I'm sorry to tell you, Sean, a lot of these pioneers and pilots are probably not going to work. But we are seeing a lot, compared to a few years ago, we've made a lot of progress, and I think a few years from now, we'll hopefully see a lot more.
Thank you so much. Thanks to all of the panelists. I also want to thank Tom Reed, Lisa Hartman. I think everyone can stay if any of you have some additional questions. Most of all, I want to thank my colleague, Penny Duckham, for putting together what I think was a really terrific event and conversation. Thank you.